American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Ahead this hour, we speak with one father about the experience of navigating his wife's miscarriage and subsequent abortion, a lost pregnancy through the lens of a dad. We'll also check in on hummingbirds. The tiny aviators have migrated back to North Carolina in recent weeks, and one researcher stops by with some tips for how to lure them in for a look. First, however, is state politics. The North Carolina General Assembly is scheduled to gavel back in this month for its short legislative session. Here for a preview of what to expect and what might be on the horizon, the agenda is Colin Campbell, WNC Capitol Bureau Chief. Hi, Colin.
Morning, Jeff.
Okay. Next week, short session, theoretically an 8 to 10 week stretch. Budget is the top priority on the docket. Remind us, please, what the budget-making process entails. What are they doing with the budget in this even-numbered year?
Yeah, so in even-numbered years, there's a little bit less pressure on the budget process because last year they passed a two-year budget, so that tends to take care of state spending for the fiscal year that starts in July. However, they often make adjustments based on revenues. Usually it's that they have more money to spend as a result of the second year of the budget cycle, so they can go back and add additional raises, additional programs and spending that they didn't do, maybe change some stuff around where there might have been a program that fell through or a mistake in the original budget. So that's what we're looking at as sort of the big agenda item going into the short session.
Okay. Tax day, a couple of days ago. We don't yet have the revenue, the complete revenue forecast for the coming fiscal year, do we?
Not yet. That's what they're waiting on. And tax day, as you mentioned, is sort of the point where they actually have that data. They see how much we actually wrote on our checks to pay our taxes or how much we got back in return on a tax return and then can establish what the revenue picture looks like going into this budget process.
So adjustments are going to come in one direction or the other. They're going to stash some money away to the rainy day fund, the savings fund, as they've done for years now. What else do you anticipate is going to materialize within this budget conversation?
I think you're going to hear a lot about education issues. House Speaker Tim Moore has already told us that he thinks with the Opportunity Scholarship, the private school voucher program, that that's going to need an additional about $300 million to meet the demand of all the people that applied in the last few months since they eliminated the eligibility caps that, you know, there's no income level at which you can't at least apply for this program and be eligible for it. So that's going to be one thing. But you'll see a lot of tension with the Democrats and the governor over whether to spend money on that versus other education needs. Obviously, the Leandro court decision is still looming out there. They're not going to follow that,
right.
But certainly there's going to be a push to do more with teacher salaries, with school funding. So you'll see, I think, a lot of that in the calculus. You also have child care centers that are asking for several hundred million dollars to make up for some federal funding that's going away in June that's putting a lot of them at risk of closure. So a lot of education-related stuff is going to be the, I think, the central portions of the debate in this budget process.
You mentioned the Democratic governor, Roy Cooper. This is his eighth and final year. He is term limited. He has been very much a part of the budget process during some years of his governorship. Those, I should note, are years when his veto had some more teeth. There are veto-proof margins at the legislature now. To what extent is Cooper involved in the process, and what is he really, we hear a lot of education talk out of him, but what is he really pushing for here? Is he involved, and what is he calling for?
Yeah, so he will have an actual budget proposal that's part of the process where he comes out with his recommendations. The recommendations are not in any way binding. The legislature, even when there's a Republican governor, doesn't tend to really follow a lot of that. So I think because he's made this the year of public schools in his mind, you're going to see a lot of his budget priorities related to education. But at the end of the day, Republicans do have a veto-proof supermajority. They're not going to need Democrats. They're not going to need the governor to get behind whatever budget proposal they come out with, so long as they keep their party in line and get all 72 Republicans in the House on board.
School voucher is going to be one, just to drop that footnote in there, that we talk, I think, a lot about on the Friday News Roundup here on Due South in the weeks and months to come. So this short legislative session gets going next week. I want to at least touch on diversity, equity, and inclusion. DEI, of course, for short. It's another touch point likely on the horizon. I'm going to give you a loaded one to start. I'm sorry. Is this more policy or election year politics?
I think a lot of it is election year politics. This is following the footsteps of Florida, and they've basically said that. I mean, discussion was touched off by some comments by UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees member Jim Blaine, former top aide to Senate Leader Phil Berger, sort of someone, when he says something, you could have expected Berger's views are being reflected in that, and he wants to essentially do what Ron DeSantis did in Florida with banning diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts on college campuses. Exactly what that looks like remains to be seen, but certainly recognizing this is an election year, they want to get in this hot-button topic.
reporters like yourself getting ready for the short legislative session. Last week on the floor of the North Carolina State House, you convened with the Republican House Speaker Tim Moore of Cleveland County, and this issue of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, came up. And here is a portion of what Speaker Moore said to y'all at the gaggle last week.
I'll speak for me on this. You know, I think we need to make sure that there's free and open exchange of ideas at the university. Every viewpoint deserves to be heard. There shouldn't be indoctrination. There shouldn't be people made, regardless of political stripe or anything else, no one should be made to feel inferior because of their position on something. No speech should be just squelched like that. Now, if it's threat speech or anything like we've seen with some of the anti-Israeli speech that's out there, that's over the top the other way. That needs to be dealt with. That creates a hostile and a dangerous environment. But in terms of, you know, what we've seen of kind of an indoctrination, we don't need that.
That's Tim Moore speaking with Colin Campbell, WNC Capitol Bureau Chief, and other reporters last week on the floor of the North Carolina House. Colin, I need you to square, I think, some of that for me. I'm hearing no hate speech, no indoctrination speech, yet no one's words should be muted. Like, it doesn't quite line up to me as I heard that cut.
Yeah, and so it makes it really, the big question is, what is this actually going to look like? And he laid out sort of a process where he wants to take the time with how this particular legislation is crafted and what's limited on college campuses, what's not limited. He mentioned Israel. He also wants to expand the definition of anti-Semitism in state law that might get into the territory of, can you criticize the Israeli government's actions in Gaza? There's a lot of different examples that we really don't have a sense of what they're going to do about that and how specific they want to go with what they tell the UNC system to do.
Colin Campbell, WNC Capitol Bureau Chief, host of the Fantastic Politics Podcast, here with us on Due South. You can engage with his reporting at WNC.org and listen to the pod wherever you download podcasts. One more on this DEI question, because I started with policy versus politics. In terms of the policy, what are they trying to do here? What are they calling for specifically, or are we not quite that far in the process?
We don't exactly know. I mean, the example that's been cited is Florida, where you've basically, the government there has said no DEI of any sort. We're getting some hints of this from the UNC System Board of Governors just today. They're having a discussion about repealing some DEI policies in the university's policy manuals that deal with DEI officers, which are currently required to be on every college campus. They're supposed to have a plan for how to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion on their campus. They're now looking at repealing that. Those are, of course, appointees from the legislature who make those decisions at the university system level. And whether we see a broader, more sweeping approach from the legislature, I think, is probably the next shoe to drop on this issue.
We heard from the speaker a moment ago. I think a lot of our listeners will recall Tim Moore. He's the outgoing speaker. He's running for Congress in the 14th District. This is a Mecklenburg-adjacent district that stretches west toward his home of Kings Mountain. This makes this about Tim Moore, his last term atop the State House. Who's replacing him? And is the transition kind of taking effect yet? Like, are you seeing this shift?
You're starting to see a little bit of it. And originally there was multiple top lieutenants to Tim Moore who wanted to be the next speaker. They have now coalesced behind House Rules Chairman Destin Hall, who's sort of has been the number two to Moore. So it's really a continuation of Moore's speakership in a lot of ways. And so you see that transition coming into place. I think the big question for Moore, sort of in his lame duck session and having a bit of senioritis, does that cause him to help actually adjourn the session on time at the end of June, like he claims that they're going to do? Or does he have a lot of last-minute things he wants to get done while he's still in that chair before he moves up and gets ready for Congress?
We've got a couple of more moments. I want to ask you about some issues that have sputtered out in recent sessions. Specifically, I'm thinking about medical marijuana, thinking about casinos near the Virginia border. Advancing legislation from idea to enacted law can take years, and that's a common thing. But I'm wondering if either of those, or if there are other topics that you think might have something of a breakthrough here in the next few months.
You know, I think medical marijuana will be one to watch, whether the fact that the House might be more interested in doing it now that they're past their primaries on the Republican side and don't have to worry about someone challenging them over that issue. The Senate's going to put some pressure on that issue for sure. And then on the gambling side, Senate Leader Phil Berger seems to have backed off the idea of adding casinos. He saw some blowback in his district over that. There's still talk of video lottery terminals, which is basically a little gambling machine in gas stations and bars and things like that. House Speaker Tim Moore says they want to potentially look at that, but go through the full legislative process with committee hearings. Whether they can do that in a short session sort of remains to be seen, or whether that gets kicked to 2025. We'll find out soon.
Okay. I think when we size up, tee up, frame up policy, we've got another minute or so here. It's important to talk about what is happening, and it's also important to talk about what they're not going to touch and why. So what are they not going to touch in this election year and why, if anything comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, there's pretty much anything that's on the Democratic Party radar. I think you can expect that they're not going to do. Abortion is one thing they say they're not doing anything else with. We've seen other states around the South go more restricted than the 12-week ban that the legislature enacted last year. Every time we've asked leadership, do they want to go beyond that with this short session? The answer is no. That said, they have not said much about 2025. So I think that's what we're looking for as the next things to happen potentially on the abortion issue.
My addendum was going to be they do not want to touch it in 2024. 2025 will potentially be a much different story. Colin Campbell is WNC's Capital Bureau Chief. You can read his reporting at our website, and you can listen to the Politics Podcast wherever you do that on-demand listening. Colin, thank you for the knowledge.
Thanks for having me.
All right. On the other side, we turn our attention to the smallest bird in the North Carolina land. It weighs less than an ounce. It can flap its wings 70 times per second. And it has recently returned to North Carolina. A researcher shares how to spot and attract the hummingbird. And later this hour, we return to our series About Dad Time with a heavier conversation about what it's like to be in a support role when your partner loses a pregnancy. This is listener-supported Due South. Stay tuned. We're back in just a moment.
You're listening to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. Hummingbird season has arrived in North Carolina. And if you're a bird watcher or even just someone with a keen eye, you may have already spotted a few of these fast-fluttering wanders. For those listeners who want to see more hummingbirds, maybe even by attracting them to your backyard or balcony, we have a special guest with us today. I'm here with Susan Campbell, a licensed hummingbird bander and a lead hummingbird researcher in North Carolina. Susan has been working with hummingbirds for over 15 years as a research affiliate with the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and she's the co-founder of the Cape Fear Bird Observatory. Susan, welcome to Due South.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd love to start with some basics, Susan. What are some ways to really identify a hummingbird? I mean, how do you know if you've spotted one?
This is a good question because there can be some confusion with identification of hummingbirds. Sometimes people see hummingbird like moths, and so there is confusion. But ruby-throated hummingbirds, the hummingbird that we expect here in our area during the summer months, is a species that looks different whether or not you're looking at a male or a female. The males are the only ones with the ruby red throat. Now, these birds are the smallest birds that we have in North America. In our part of the U.S., east of the Mississippi, they are the only hummingbird species you're going to see during the summer months. The males have the bright ruby red throat, but females are not that colorful. And so a female is only going to look green and white and may get overlooked, especially in the vegetation, when she is cryptically moving around or sitting on her nest. She may be hard to spot. But hummingbirds are the only ones that truly hover. They can fly forwards and backwards. They can even fly upside down.
Wow.
So they are very acrobatic. But the thing about them that makes them so special, regardless of whether you're looking at a ruby-throated hummingbird or a different species somewhere else in the Americas, is that they have plumage that's very shiny. It's iridescent. It's not colored by pigment like other birds, like our familiar blue jay or cardinal. Their plumage is colored by little features of the feather that refract and reflect light and create the color that we see. And depending on the angle of the light, they may look different colors. If they're in bright sun, a male will look red in the throat and green on the back. But in the shade, he may just look black and white. So it can be tricky to sort out a hummingbird or to notice a hummingbird unless it's in very bright light. but they are the smallest and the most fast moving, agile of the birds that you will find in North Carolina.
Well, Susan, one thing I've been noticing are your fluttering earrings. I mean, I know they're hummingbirds, right? So how large is a hummingbird actually? Because I'm looking at the size of your earrings right now. So what are we talking about?
We are talking about birds that are only a couple of inches long. From the end of the bill to the tip of the tail, they're only a couple inches long. And the male only weighs about a dime, a female, about the weight of a nickel. And that's probably what allows them to be able to have the kind of lifestyle they do, the speed at which they fly, the aerobatics that they do, because they're very, very lightweight.
What do hummingbirds sound like? You know, we want to think that they're very vocal and they have a beautiful sound or hum about them. But is it the wings?
When people think about hummingbirds and they think about the humming sound that hummingbirds make, which they do make, it turns out that that sound is actually coming from their wing beats, not from their vocal apparatus. So their wings, as they move different ways, will sound a little different. The pitch of the hum will be different. They do make vocalizations, but those tend to be chirps and cheeps and chatters. So they don't sing like songbirds. And that's one of the reasons that we think that they've evolved this beautiful plumage is because of the fact that they have to use body language to get their point across and not vocalizations.
Aren't the females louder than the males?
They can be, yes. The females can be louder. The females can be more aggressive than the males. They will really, at the beginning of the breeding season in the spring, they will really push the males around when it comes to competing over a food source, because for the females, it's all business.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, they run the roost. Good, good,
they do.
Good. You know, I wonder, when did the first hummingbirds start to arrive this season in this area this year, I guess, and how long will they stay?
So ruby-throated hummingbirds return, in some cases, late March, but it's usually the first week of May that we expect to see the very first ones that have come north from the tropics, from Mexico, in some cases from Central America, where they've spent the winter. And then we will have ruby-throateds here through August and September into October. The October ruby-throateds tend to be the ones that are moving from the northern reaches of the breeding range up in Canada and heading back down towards the tropics.
And the most common species found in our area is the ruby-throated hummingbird, but are there other breeds that we should look out for?
In the summertime, we only expect to see ruby-throated hummingbirds. It is very unusual when one is spotted that looks different, that is, say, from the western U.S. We do have this happen, but it's exceedingly rare. In the wintertime, it's a whole different ballgame, because in the wintertime, we do have some western species of hummingbirds that can show up here in North Carolina. They're not common, but they do show up. But at the time of year when the birds are breeding, really don't expect to see anything other than ruby-throateds.
I was just wondering if folks should keep their phone cameras out. Like if they see a rare one and then contact you, I guess.
Exactly. That's what people do. And it's not impossible. It is not impossible. It's just unlikely that you're going to see something other than a ruby-throated during the warmer months. Another thing that people do send me photos of during the summer are white hummingbirds. And ruby-throateds can be albino. And they also can be partial albinos. So I get photos from folks once or twice a season. I will get photos of interesting looking plumages of ruby-throated hummingbirds. And rarely, we'll see a full albino. Yes, people, keep your eyes open. And if you do see an unusual looking hummingbird or you think you have something different in your yard, please let me know. I love to hear from folks.
Well, I'm here with Susan Campbell, a licensed hummingbird bander. Is that the same as a tracker?
It can be. It can be. These days, we have trackers that we can put on birds, and the technology is being developed as we speak to be able to track hummingbirds in real time.
I can't imagine trying to put something on such a tiny bird. I don't know, wing or ankle, their leg. I don't know. How do you do it?
I do put the band on the ankle, and we have special equipment that we use to form actually our bands. We make our bands ourselves from strips of aluminum that come pre-numbered. And I have cutting tools and shaping tools that I use to create these little bands. And then I have special pliers that I use to just crimp, gently crimp the little band around the ankle of the bird. And that band has a unique number letter combination. So we know everybody in a summer that's banded. And believe it or not, I recapture banded ruby-throated hummingbirds, not uncommonly. So far, they've all been my birds, the ones that I originally banded, but it is wonderful to recapture one that's got a band already that I haven't seen for a matter of months, in some cases, maybe some years.
So how many hummingbirds are we talking about, and what part of, say, North Carolina are they seen more often? Is it in this central area?
Actually, no. The most hummingbird-rich location is in our intercoastal plain. And so they will be more numerous at places like around Lake Matamiskeet is a good spot to go to look for lots of ruby-throated hummingbirds in the wild. But that's not to say that we don't have quite a few in the Piedmont. We have them in the mountains, and we have them along the coast as long as there are trees in the vicinity, because they require trees for nesting, not bushes, trees. So you can find ruby-throateds all the way across the state from Manteo up to fairly high elevation, someplace like Grandfather Mountain.
So, Susan, why do we love hummingbirds so much? I know they symbolize so much. They seem to be just a sweet bird, I guess.
They are very special. And they're a group of birds that have been special to humans for thousands of years. And I think it's because of the richness of their color, because of the vitality that they can seem to convey with their activities. They are magical. And to me, this fact that they are a tiny bird and yet they travel thousands of miles twice a year, they are just little marvels that these teeny little birds can do what they do. And they don't even really think about it very much. They just are so amazing.
So if we wanted to attract hummingbirds to our yards, for example, like what kinds of flowers should we be planting?
Okay. Hummingbirds are attracted to bright colors. I think most of us know that. They can see red much better than we can, and other bright colors. Their eyes function very differently. And so they can see red half to three quarters of a mile, of course, unobstructed view. So they've been evolving with brightly colored flowers for a long time. And we have a number of brightly colored plants, flowers, trees, shrubs, vines that they like here in North Carolina. Early in the season, you will see them using Carolina jessamine, the yellow vine, or maybe coral honeysuckle that also blooms in the early spring. But they'll also be going to native azaleas. They'll be going to tulip poplars when they start to bloom. Surprisingly, as much as they have evolved with bright colored plants, they will actually go to things that are maybe blue, even white. The thing they're after when they're going to flowers is a nectar concentration with about 25% sugar, 25 to 32% sugar. Mm. So they may go to some very small flowers, not the typical large tubular blooms that we expect to see them feeding from. So they really do go after a variety of plants. And there are many native plant possibilities. One of the best places to go and find a list is to go to the North Carolina Cooperative Extension wildlife page. But you don't need a lot of space to attract hummingbirds with plants. I know plenty of people in apartment living situations that just have a planter or two on their patio or on their deck. And so there are plenty of different choices of things that you can plant that will attract hummingbirds. But more importantly, hummingbirds are insect eaters. They cannot keep up the metabolism that they have with just sugar. They actually require a lot of protein. And so having native vegetation that supports the insects that they need to feed on and feed their young in particular is very critical.
You need like a prairie yard, don't you?
Yes, that would be fantastic. A variety of natural plants is wonderful. But even having evergreen shrubs that are native here, or trees like pines, loblolly pines or longleaf pine, but shrubs like our native hollies, These are plants that are going to hold insects because of the fact that they're evergreen and they have lots of leaf surface, and so will be very good for hummingbirds, in addition to those brightly colored blooms that you think about typically.
You know, I know there's been some controversy over feeding hummingbirds. So let's talk about the feeders. You know, what are the best kinds to use and which ones should we be avoiding?
Okay. This is a good question because unfortunately there are feeders on the market that are not advisable. There are two different styles of feeders, saucer style feeders and reservoir style feeders. The reservoir style has been on the market for a long time. And one of the brands of reservoir style feeder is the Perky Pet feeder. It's very well known. It is not a bad feeder to use. It just has a lot of parts that you have to clean. And most reservoir style feeders do have lots of parts that you need to clean. And cleaning a feeder is critical. When you use a saucer style feeder, there are less nooks and crannies. They're easier to open. Very simple to clean and refill. Because when it gets warm and humid in North Carolina, and that's happens pretty early, you need to have a feeder that you can take apart and clean completely about every 3 days, especially if it's in direct sunlight. Also, you need to have feeding ports that are large enough that the birds can safely get their tongue into the feeder to feed. And we have feeders on the market that have slits or very tiny holes, and those are problematic. The problem has been over the years with hummingbird feeders, especially the reservoir style feeders, that they will attract bees and wasps because they seep or drip. The only reservoir style feeder that does not do this is the Dr. JB's Clean feeder. It's a reservoir style feeder that comes apart easily, that has larger holes and pops apart. And because of the baffle in the base that's patented, it's very special, the food is not going to seep or drip out of the openings, and so you're not going to attract bees and wasps. Now, you won't attract bees and wasps with saucer-style feeders either, so that's really a plus when it comes to saucer-style feeders. If your feeder gets dirty, microbes start to grow in that feeder, you could be making your hummingbirds sick. We know that can happen.
Should you be buying a pre-made hummingbird nectar, or can you just make it at home?
I totally support the concept of making your own food at home. The prepackaged mixes have preservatives and additives in them of questionable safety. And I will tell you that some of the food mixes that are being sold, and by the way, they're expensive, these mixes. The food mixes that are being sold have elements of them that the birds don't like the taste of. So just using table sugar and water in the proportion of 4 parts water, 1 part sugar is all you need. No dye, no additives of any kind. It's best, especially if you're on city water, to boil the water before you add the sugar, because that way you'll get rid of any kind of city additives to the water. But I've been known in times of crisis, like after Hurricane Fran, to use rainwater to make hummingbird food when we didn't have any power and we didn't have any water running in the house.
Well, I have just one more question for you. I know our listeners may want to know how to best get their questions answered about hummingbirds. So I want you to tell us that. But also, I understand that the hummingbird population is a slight decline. You know, what's causing that?
Well, I think the decline in the population is something here in North Carolina that is fairly complicated, but it has to do with the fact that our insect populations are declining. And a lot of us have heard about this, maybe with bees or with butterflies or with lightning bugs. But the tiny insects that hummingbirds need are also declining. We're almost certain of it. And this is because of two things. One, because of the native vegetation also declining. The vegetation that these insects require for their life cycle is just not around like it used to be. We've replaced it with non-native plants or replaced it with nothing, with just grass or nothing. The other part of this is that there's a lot of chemical on the landscape. And not only is there chemical being applied in the form of herbicides and pesticides, but we also have had so much chemical, including agricultural and industrial chemicals, that worldwide the atmosphere contains chemical residue. And every time it rains, that rain is going to be impacting in a negative way the insect populations, especially during the summertime.
So where can our listeners find you and find information about hummingbirds?
There are a couple ways that you can find information. Number one is to email me directly at susan@ncavs.com. Also, you can find information on our North Carolina Hummingbirds Facebook page. That's a great place to find out also about when I'm doing local programs, because I'll be out banding for the general public during the course of the summer, and our events will be posted there. But also you can find hummingbird information on our Cape Fear Bird Observatory website or at our Facebook page or Instagram, but you can also certainly contact me directly.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Susan Campbell is a licensed hummingbird bander and a lead hummingbird researcher in North Carolina. She's also a research affiliate with the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and the co-founder of the Cape Fear Bird Observatory. Coming up, my co-host Jeff DeBeery and About Dad Time. This is Due South.
In Mexico, in the winter, you're Tennessee. In the spring, you come and go like a whisper, leaving me the most beautiful dream. Hummingbird, hummingbird, you're the sound of these strings.
Welcome back. It's Due South on listener-supported WUNC. I'm Jeff DeBeery. Time now for another installment in our series, About Dad Time. It's a segment where dads talk about fatherhood, the ups and downs, the funny, the challenging, and sometimes the things we should be talking about more often. Today, a heavier topic, what it's like when your wife or partner loses a pregnancy. And a heads up here, we're talking about miscarriage and abortion on this installment. Here in studio is Mike Venutolo Montovani. He's a writer who has contributed to the New York Times, The Guardian, The Bitter Southerner, and Southern Living, among a variety of other publications. He also has a newsletter. It's titled, Being a Dad is Hard as F asterisk CK. He lives in Chapel Hill. Mike, welcome to Due South.
Thanks for having me.
How long have you been a dad?
I have a six-year-old son, just turned six, and two-year-old daughter. So 8 years cumulatively, but 6 years on the calendar.
Yeah, and it might be more like 30 or 35 when you think about like dog years, parent years, somewhere in there.
That's right.
Favorite aspect of being a papa?
My favorite aspect of being a papa, it sounds cheesy, but when my kids call me daddy.
Sure.
Like that breaks my heart.
There's only two people in the world that can.
But my favorite thing about it is watching them figure out the world. It's awesome. And I don't mean that in the way that we bastardize the word awesome. I mean, it's like, yeah. It's awesome. Watching them learn things. You know, my daughter is at the point now where she's starting to, she speaks, but she's really starting to form sentences.
Yep.
My son is starting to read. So just watching them figure out how everything works is really kind of amazing.
Worst part of the gig?
Poop. I've had poop cake under my fingernails for the last 6 years.
No, your hands look pretty clean.
They're not bad.
Did you have a manicure?
Worst part about it is being the bad guy, doing the hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, my own father, who I have a great relationship with, you know, to this day and always did when I was a kid, he had a saying when I was a kid that I remember one time, I think I was probably a teenager, and I said, you know, the other guy's dads are cool, man. They're like friends. And my dad said, well, I'm your father. I'll be your friend when you're 30. Until then, I'm your father. And that's hard for me, you know, coming down on my son, especially because he's, you know, six. He's really into pushing boundaries.
Yeah.
Yanking him out of the playground when he does something wrong. You know?
Power struggle, baby.
It's the power struggle, but kids need boundaries. You got to, you know.
Yes.
But it's hard.
And little boys are constantly testing the limits of these boundaries.
He's about, what do they call him? A habitual line pusher. So when I have to sit in the car and watch him sobbing, crying, that's the hardest part.
So your blog, you've done about 100 installments of these, and we're going to focus largely today on one particular essay that you wrote a couple of years ago. It's titled, I Have My Daughter, Thanks to an Abortion. And we're going to focus on this elective abortion that your wife had 2 years ago. You've written about this experience. I believe you've spoken publicly about it previously. Mm-hmm. And your wife, Emily, is, just to be clear, in support of you sharing this story.
Yeah.
Tell us about the circumstances, the setting in your life, when you and your wife made the initial choice to try to conceive at the time a second child.
So, right. So we had our son, and I'm terrible with dates, generally with numbers. I often have to ask Emily how old I am.
But you're 42. We've been talking about 10 minutes now. And your son, I believe, was born in...
So when he was, I guess he must have, if he's 4 years older than my daughter, so he must have been three. We knew we wanted to have a second kid. We knew we just... probably just wanted to have two kids. Emily got pregnant, and as she did with our son, she had a really rough pregnancy. Morning sickness every day, all day, every day. Between the three pregnancies, the two children I have and the pregnancy that she miscarried, which was the nexus of this abortion, my wife was sick in bed for like 20 months. Which was brutal. It was brutal to watch. The most brutal part for me was when we had our first kid, before we had our first kid, when she was pregnant with him, because I was just alone. I was by myself for 8 months while she was sick or laying in bed or sleeping. You know, when he was born, I had my...
Your duties.
I was plenty occupied. But anyway, so she was really sick the second time, and we just kind of expected it because with our son, she had been really sick. And she went to go get an ultrasound. I stayed home with my son. Timing didn't work. Obviously, I would have loved to have been there with her. But yes, that's what it was. So it was a COVID thing. I couldn't go with her. She called me sobbing from the parking lot. There was nothing. There was no heartbeat. There was no signs of life, et cetera, et cetera. The cruel joke was that she had been sick for a long time, and her body thought she was still pregnant. And her body was progressing. She was getting bigger. Everything was progressing as if there was a baby growing inside of her uterus, except that there wasn't. It had stopped, you know, several weeks before. And so the doctor gave, or the, you know, whoever gave my wife a couple of options. One was to let nature take its course. And the other one was to just, you know, to use a crude term, just flush it out and be done with it. And obviously, given the state of her sickness, given that it wasn't we're not talking about a pregnancy that had some sort of genetic deformity or genetic malfunction or whatever, right, whatever the correct medical term is. We're talking about this wasn't a viable option. This wasn't, you know. And so we chose, obviously, quickly and without even any debate, to have an abortion so that Emily could just be done with being sick more than anything. It may have been different if she wasn't so sick. Sure. I don't know, but she was throwing up all day, every day, in bed, all day, every day. So that was kind of the decision.
All right. So Michael Vignatolo Montovani here on Due South. And I'm going to ask you to read a portion of this essay that you wrote a couple of years ago about the moment that you're describing.
Emily had what's called a silent or missed miscarriage, one in which the pregnancy ceases without any physical markers of a non-viable pregnancy. The ultrasound at 12 weeks showed nothing but an empty pregnancy sac. The doctor laid out a trio of options. First, Emily could return as soon as possible for an abortive procedure called a D&E, or dilation and evacuation. Second, she could take a prescribed pill that would speed the process of Emily's body rejecting the pregnancy. Finally, she could allow nature to take its course, however long that might take.
And what was the next step? What happened?
She chose to do the D&E and just be done with it. There was no sense, like as I said, there was, you know, she was so sick that there was no sense in waiting.
And are you, the dad in this moment, are you angry? Are you confused? Are you sad? I imagine it's several emotions, but take me back.
Mostly this happened. So in the essay, I talk about how we refer to this thing as the zygote because it wasn't, to again, use a crude analogy. It's like how, you know, farmers, they never name their animals because once you name the animal, then you can't. So we refer to this thing as the zygote until, because of that, I think that helped us a lot because we hadn't developed an attachment yet. Yeah. We didn't see it on an ultrasound. It wasn't the same with our son.
You didn't hear the heartbeat.
Didn't hear the heartbeat. Yeah. There was never a heartbeat. So it was in that regard, it was for me, speaking only for me, not my wife, obviously, it was very easy. It was just, I want my buddy, my best friend, to be better, to feel better because I'm so tired of looking at her being so ill.
That's your wife, Emily, in that instance. Yeah. How did you handle this with your son, who would have been three-ish at the time? Because he obviously can see mom getting bigger. Three-year-olds are generally curious, but three-year-olds can't understand this.
Yeah, and I think the funny thing is we told him what happened, and our son is—he's very— he's very, in a lot of regards, he's very easy. And in this way, he kind of was. And he just kind of said, okay, you know, can we turn on, can we turn on the cartoon now? Can we watch Cars now? And, you know, luckily, Emily got luckily/accidentally pregnant again shortly thereafter. So there really wasn't much of a, I don't know if he knew what was going to happen. Even in regards to, hey, you have another sibling on the way. I don't know if he knew what that meant. Because he was still very young at the time. So he didn't really take it hard. It was just at the time, he was just kind of like, okay, what's next?
My wife and I tell a quick story, or I'll tell a quick story that my wife and I have told before, which is our son was 3 years and 3 days old when his sister was born. And he saw mom getting big, and we told him that sister was coming, and he could understand the words to some degree, but it wasn't until we brought our daughter home on that Saturday night. He was still awake and he came downstairs. And my parents have a couple of great pictures of him meeting his sister. And the look on his face is like, oh my God, what has happened here? So it doesn't matter, like, really, I think what you tell them, it's until you see or feel that little creature in front of you.
Yeah, and our son was never one for, like, I mean, he did put his ear up to Emily's belly when she was pregnant with our daughter. You know, he did. He was much more curious about when sister's coming, what should I, but it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't until she was there. It wasn't until she was a real thing.
Why did you decide to write about this?
That's just the way I kind of process everything. A and B, I mean, so the reason I started this newsletter, Being a Dad as Hard as You Know What, is because when Emily was pregnant with our son, I turned to literature for everything. You know, the answer, one thing my mother instilled with me, voracious reader and a writer herself, was that anything you ever want to know, you find in a book. End of story. Like, you know, go find the answer. It's in a book somewhere. And so when my wife was pregnant with our son, I scoured bookstores, I scoured Amazon, and everything I could find, everything I found aimed at fathers, new or expectant, was bad humor. I call it
cheesy puns.
Cheesy puns. Yeah. Like, dude, your fetus is the size of a football this week. And I'm a very, you know, if you read my newsletter, you can, I'm a very earnest guy. I'm a very open guy. And I wanted what the moms got, but for dads. And so I come from kind of a punk rock, hardcore background, DIY, and kind of the ethos I've always lived by is like, if the thing in the world doesn't exist that you want, then go make the thing. Just don't wait for it to come out. Go.
If it's not in a book already.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I did find one book, and it's a beautiful book. And in the newsletter, one of the facets of my newsletter is I interview some dads I like and admire and would love to have you do one.
And I will do it.
His name is Elisha Cooper, and he wrote this beautiful story called Crawling. He's a cartoonist. He draws for The New Yorker a bunch. And it's about his first year with his daughter. Beautiful, super heartfelt, super earnest, super funny. You can be funny and heartfelt at the same time. But beyond that, I didn't find anything. And so with my wife's blessing, I started this newsletter and eventually came to this piece about her abortion. And the breakdown we have is usually she proofreads it, and not only proofreads it, but
offer some edits.
It offers some edits.
Has the veto pen?
She has the veto pen. Okay. Yeah, when they would, you know, when they would cross it out in black marker, you know, like what they would do in the in wartime.
Redacted.
Yeah, yes. Redacted. That's right. That's the word I'm looking for. And she's vetoed a couple things, but for the most part, especially when it came to this, you know, her thing was when this happened to her. Every woman, not every woman, but nearly every woman she spoke to, their response was, "Oh, I had a miscarriage too." Or I had an abortion too. And it made her very angry because she's like, why can't we talk about this stuff? So that was kind of the process of, hey, Em, do you mind if I want to write about this. I want to write about your miscarriage and your subsequent abortion. And are you cool with it? And, you know, obviously she almost always gets the first read of the newsletter before it goes out.
I think maybe to just put a finer point on it, it's not normalizing something that's happening. It's normalizing the conversation about something that has long been happening for a lot of women, to a lot of families. So your wife has this abortion procedure. A few months later, you conceive again.
Yeah.
And your daughter is born 9 months later.
Yeah.
Tell me about your daughter.
So my daughter is, she was purely accidental. My wife and I wanted to wait a little bit until, because that process of her being pregnant and this sickness and the abortion, it was all a lot. And she wanted to wait. And in November, I think she got the abortion in October. And she said, we'll try January. We'll start again in January. We'll start fresh. Long story short, Emily and I are both super progressive people. Emily and I were both celebrating the night that Joe Biden was confirmed as the president. And we realized only about a year and a half later that that was the night that our daughter was conceived. TMI. We thought about naming her Kamala, but
I was going to say, what about Josephine?
but yeah, so she came as a total accident.
Okay.
We knew we wanted a second kid.
Sure.
But she came about three
in
months.
In that moment.
In that moment, we were not ready for Emily to be pregnant again. We were not ready for her. And so we had her. And again, that's kind of the whole point of this essay that I read from that you chose. If my wife didn't have that abortion, we wouldn't have our daughter. And that's not to say we wouldn't have another daughter that we would love just as much. That's not to say if my wife's pregnancy, her second pregnancy, did work out, we wouldn't have our daughter. But we do. And our daughter, I think I've told you this before, but I call her a cannonball of sunshine.
Uh-huh.
And she's this like messy little blonde haired, you know, wild. She's like something out of a Maurice Sendak cartoon, you know? And, you know, she's the wild thing. She is through and through a true blue second child. She's fearless. She's reckless. She's constantly hurting herself. She's constantly refusing my help because she's, you know, she wants to do everything her big brother can do. And she's so funny and hilarious. And the one thing I didn't realize until we had her was that how funny these kids can be. Because my son was not, he is a very funny boy, but she's like, as soon as she could start to communicate, she was trying to make everyone laugh. It was very, and so, you know, again, the title, the very title of this essay that you chose was, I Have My Daughter Thanks to an Abortion. It was, so if we wouldn't have her. And I know everybody says this about their kids, and rightly so, but everywhere we go, you know, all of her teachers at her daycare, you know, she's just, she makes the world a better place to be. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things where I can't imagine my life without either of our kids.
Yeah. Oh, no.
For two.
And it's crazy to think about that now, right?
Yeah.
Like it was just 6 years ago. It was just the two of us.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine it now.
Mostly I just think about what did we do all day?
Yeah. It's so much time.
It's so much
time. I think I had more money.
Like, I definitely had more money. Yeah. I mean, I we're just now, Emily and I are just now just starting to become adults again, in which like we take trips by ourselves and we like hang out with other friends. And I'm just slowly starting to remember what that means. But yeah, no, it's, the world is a better place because my daughter's in it. The world's a better place because both of my kids are in it. But every time I often think about that second, you know, that miscarriage, that second pregnancy and the subsequent abortion and think about had that worked out, we wouldn't have our daughter. So that's it puts things in perspective.
His newsletter is titled Being a Dad is Hard as F*CK. He has also written for The New York Times, The Guardian, The Bitter Southerner and Southern Living, among other publications. His name is Michael Vignatolo Montovani. And he lives in Chapel Hill. Mike, thanks for joining us on Due South.
Thanks for having me.
This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. For Leonita Inge, I'm Jeff Tiberi. For more Due South, go to DueSouthRadio.org. Download and subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen. We'll talk to you again tomorrow at 10:00.